I'm Catherine Lana, and on behalf of Browsers Bookshop, I've been thrilled to organise this evening's event with Lindsay McRae and the Penguins. If you've spoken to me about this event or read my newsletter, you'll know that I've been fanatical about this book because I think it's brilliant, and I'm sure you're all going to agree when you've read it and heard from Lindsay this evening. I'm certainly looking forward to all he has to tell us and show us with the slideshow. So he's going to talk for about 45 minutes with the slides. There will be the opportunity for questions, and then you can meet him further for further chat and have your book signed if you haven't done already after that. So I think we're ready to hand over to you. If I could just have the lights turned down for the slides and introduce you to Lindsay McRae. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. We've been doing this sort of little talk now since the book was published last Monday, and we've visited all these amazing little bookshops, and this is just another one. So thank you for having me. I could go on for days, as you can imagine, about spending a year in Antarctica, and I have done in the book. But tonight I've selected four or five different occasions that happened while I was there to go into in more depth. I completely understand Antarctica is an incredibly remote and harsh place to get to, and it's so expensive as well. Plus, you can only get there in the short period over summer when the weather allows. So I hope through this this talk and the book, for those of you who end up reading it, it gives you that little glimpse into what life is like down there in arguably the most beautiful place on Earth. So 5 years ago now, the BBC thought up this new concept of making a program which was ended up being called Dynasties. Like Planet Earth these days and Blue Planet, wildlife programs nowadays sort of consist of short 5-minute sequences of key pieces of behavior from around the world, and they jump about just with these massive bits of behavior. But what Dynasties wanted to do was follow an animal family through a key part of their life, most of which was over a year. Anyway, they thought this idea up, took it to David Attenborough. And his response was, "You're mad. You're absolutely mad. We could never fill an hour of telly these days without knowing what's going to happen." And this was incredibly risky. We had no idea whether, these creatures would still be alive after the first trip of filming, you know, in which case that's it, gone. So, yeah, it was an incredibly risky, but these were the five species selected. And I don't think you could get five more charismatic species for the first in this kind of programming to happen. At this point, I'd been filming wildlife professionally for about 8 years, and I'd been very lucky to travel all over the UK and quite a lot of the world, but Antarctica and filming emperors had still been top of my list. And as you can imagine, filming trips down there are few and far between, so I still didn't quite think it was going to happen. Anyway, I got this call one day asking if I'd like to go to Antarctica. But there was a catch. The trip would be 11 months rather than normal 5 to 6 weeks. I had these crazy ideas in my head of filming in Antarctica under blue skies, massive icebergs, pretty birds like this. I didn't really quite know what was involved or what these birds had to go through. I think, like everybody, I was a lover of penguins and I was desperate to see emperors, because sort of everybody knows what an emperor penguin looks like. A lot of people know their life cycle. So I was, desperate to get down there, but it was blissfully unaware of what I'd have to do to be able to fulfill my dream. Just to give you an idea of their life cycle, emperors are strange because they breed through the Antarctic winter. They rely on the frozen ocean as a platform to breed on. And obviously that happens in an Antarctic winter. So to film the majority of their breeding behavior, I'd have to be there in the winter when the ice was at its strongest. But that meant a period of isolation. So from the end of February through to the beginning of November, obviously the opposite in the southern hemisphere to here, the weather becomes so unpredictable that planes can't fly, the sea freezes so far north that ships can't sail. So it's simply a case of being dumped there at the end of February and not being picked up again until November. So it had massive consequences, and I had to make a lot of sacrifices to fulfill my dream. But luckily, I had a girlfriend at the time, a wife just before I left, but I had a girlfriend, two dogs, a house. So I did have commitments, but my wife knew that this was a dream of mine, and she simply couldn't say, "No, you're not going." So we decided to go ahead with the trip. Obviously, for a trip that would be so long, it took a huge amount of preparation. I went to Germany to try on, well, get our polar clothing fitted. Obviously, this kind of kit was vital in keeping me alive when we were outside in such horrendous conditions. We did lots of GPS and remote wilderness training. Believe it or not, because we'd be staying in a station on our own, we had to be completely self-sufficient. So if the station set alight, we'd be the people that would have to put the fire out. So we had to go through a firefighter course. And we spent a couple of weeks on a glacier in Austria, pulling ourselves and our colleagues out of crevasses. Because, you know, being on an ice shelf, you know, the place can be covered and you don't quite know what to wear. So we needed to be able to look after ourselves and our colleagues. I was thoroughly checked medically from a place that is very difficult to pull me out of. Obviously, my bosses wanted to know that I was physically and mentally fit enough to survive the 8 months of isolation when nobody could get to me. That picture in the top right is the exact spot I was stood when I got a call from my wife. I couldn't believe I had mobile signal either, but she rang me and said that she was pregnant, and this was in the August before I left, which put a whole new spin on things. We had spoken about having children, but we thought, you know, we'll give it a go and see what happens. It's either a case of trying now and you know, taking what comes, or waiting the 2 years of prep plus my year away. So as it was the first time, we thought, you know what, we'll do this and see how it goes. So on the longest day of the year in the Southern Hemisphere, the 21st of December, this is where we landed, and this is my home for the next 11 months. This is Neumar 3 station, belonging to the German Antarctic Research Group. Neumar is one of the most sophisticated scientific research stations on Antarctica. It was built in 2009, and it's actually built on an ice shelf. It's not on solid land. So that means, before I went down, ice shelves and sea ice confused me a bit. But basically, an ice shelf is the end of a glacier. And these glaciers that are flowing off the continent in Antarctica, in this part of Antarctica, are enormous. So the station there is sat on about 200 meters of ice. And then below that, God knows how many hundreds of meters of open water. And because it's on a glacier, it's slowly moving towards the edge every year, approximately 200 meters every year. So the station's been given a lifespan of about 30 years, in which, and after that 30 years, the whole thing will be just disassembled, and a new, no doubt, even more high-tech station will be built back where this original one was put. But yeah, an incredible feat of engineering. And a lot of people ask me before I go, would I be camping in Antarctica? But thankfully, no. This was where I'd be staying. Inside was, you know, quite embarrassingly, for living in possibly the harshest conditions our planet has to offer, I was inside living in probably the most comfortable conditions I'd have. And yeah, we had an enormous kitchen, a big gym, you know, lovely living quarters. There was even a sauna. And I'm telling the truth, I didn't go in it. The whole year, I didn't go in it once. But as you can see, you know, fantastic medical facilities. And that's important because they need to be able to deal with any eventuality, not being able to get back home. In the summer, that short season between November and February, it's a really busy place because that's the only time people can get in and out easily, or relatively easily. There's about 60 people on the station, and they include people that are making sure the vehicles are still working, doing maintenance on the station to make sure that's still all right, extra chefs to look after everybody, cleaners to make sure the station's still clean. So it's a really busy place. But when February comes around and the core winter crew are left on their own, there would only be 12 of us left. So that would include myself, a television director and a field assistant. But jumping on the back of the Antarctic research team, they always employ a team to live there throughout the winter. And that includes a chef, a mechanic, an electrician, an IT specialist, and 4 or 5 scientists. And of course, a doctor. The doctor is the station leader, so he has nothing else to worry about. So if nothing goes wrong, he's got quite an easy year because there's nothing else to do. But he has surgical experience and obviously knows what he's doing. The medical technology down there is so far advanced that should anything seriously go wrong that our doctor couldn't deal with, There's a telemedicine system in place where live patient data is displayed back in a hospital in Germany, in northern Germany, in Bremerhaven in this instance, where specialists in whatever field is required can talk back to our doctor and talk him through what to do. So that did, you know, make me think a little bit easier should I get run over by a skidoo or something. But we did get warned that not everything can be done, and should we have to be evacuated, it is possible, but the chance is extremely unlikely. In fact, it's much easier to get somebody out of the International Space Station than it is to get somebody out of an Antarctic winter. So this was our first big challenge. We arrived at Neumayer and our colony of emperor penguins. A lot of people ask me, why didn't we go to a British station to film this? And the only British station that had an emperor colony back then, unfortunately, this is only 4 or 5 years ago, their colony has now collapsed. It was the second biggest, but due to changes in ice conditions, that colony of 20 odd thousand birds has moved because the sea ice isn't lasting long enough. However, that colony was 60 kilometers from Halley, their station. Not an easy journey to be doing on skidoo backwards and forwards every day. Whereas the colony at Neumayer was only 7 kilometers from the station. So on a good day, a trip on a skidoo that would only take about 10 minutes. Plus, obviously, Neumayer was, you know, an incredible facility to look after us for the whole year. This was our first big challenge. We turned up to Atka Bay, which is the sort of inlet where the penguins breed every year. And Atka Bay was 140 square kilometres in size that had been frozen for the previous 5 or 6 years, I think, and even in the summer hadn't melted. So the penguins had been happily coming backwards and forwards. And even through the summer when they go out to sea to feed, there'd always been birds there. We'd obviously arrived at the end of their previous breeding season. But very quickly, the whole bay, to our luck, broke up and disappeared and took the penguins with it. And all of a sudden, we had these massive icebergs drifting in and out, but no penguins to film. Very frustrating, because we were then left with potentially 4 or 5 months of not doing very much, waiting for the sea to refreeze to form that platform for the birds to return on to breed. We'd always asked, what other wildlife are we going to see? You know, Antarctica's famous for these amazing wildlife sightings. And a lot of people on the station, well, they don't monitor the wildlife in Antarctica at this particular bay. All their research is on atmospheric conditions. So every trip we were making to the edge of the ice, to this, you know, patch of open water, we were coming back with what we'd seen, and every story was new to them. They didn't quite know what they had on their doorstep. And just to give you an idea, this is one evening that we had with an incredible encounter with a group of whales.
Yeah.
Are
you kidding?
No. Hey, just here in this bit of water.
Yeah, we've been surprised by a whole pod of killer whales that are finding any little gap on the sea ice below us to spy hop all over the place. It's absolutely magical.
Amazing. That was what I'd consider a proper Antarctic scene. I didn't expect to see any orcas in this part of the Antarctic, especially where we are now. I mean, there's an enormous amount of sea ice between us and proper open water.
Very humbling experience. Actually, weirdly, it's quite emotional to see them in this sort of landscape. If I don't have another orca sighting in my whole life, that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, having just experienced that.
That was my director, Will Lawson, and he was the only other Englishman on the station. Our field assistant was German. And that evening was magical. We probably had about 70 individuals spy hopping. And it's a weird feeling knowing you're being eyed up for dinner, maybe. But the other reason they do that is to, obviously, they're wanting gaps in the ice to be able to breathe. And when the pack ice, you know, rams close tight in like that, they need to find a way out. So they do that to look for the next patch of open water to take their next breath and so on until they get back to open water. And this is the end of February, a week earlier than we had anticipated, about the 21st, I think. And I had weird thoughts about this day. This is the last plane leaving. So this is them taking all the summer visitors away and leaving just the 12 of us for the next 8 months. And up to this point, I'd been pretty unpopular, but I could have got home. But yeah, this day happened and it was almost like this was all we'd been waiting for. We were incredibly excited, and watching this plane disappear into the clouds, we'd been trusted with this 35 million euro station to ourselves to look after the next 8 months. But it also meant that the only help we'd get if we needed it was from our fellow teammates. There was nobody else for, I think, 800 kilometers was the next station that was manned. So yeah, it was a weird feeling, but very exciting. But we very quickly realized that we were in a dangerous place. And about a week after that last plane had left, we'd continued to make these journeys to the ice edge and film what whales we could. We'd see the odd penguin drifting by on ice floes and seals. And from Neumayr, there were three marked routes all on our GPS systems. Obviously, traveling across an ice shelf, it's quite unpredictable. So these three routes are marked as safe, and they're regularly monitored for cracks and whatnot. And we follow these routes, you know, your little blue arrows on the red line. And one day we got to the end of our track there, but our GPS is still said we had 200-300 meters to go. And you can see what's happened without any warning whatsoever. An enormous part of the ice shelf has just decided to calve overnight and was drifting off at a ridiculous rate. It was going off pretty quickly. And you can actually see there's some tracks that still cross that edge. The top edge, which is now disconnected, was where we were filming those orcas from just a week or two before, without any idea that there was a crack underneath us. And had we been on the other side of that crack when it happened, you know, we'd have been in serious trouble. There were no planes at this point, no boats, no helicopters. We'd have just slowly been drifting off. So it was a big wake-up call. And, you know, it really reminded us that we were in a, you know, pretty dangerous place. We got to the end of the end of March, and this was, you know, a good 3 months after we'd arrived, and finally the sea started showing signs of refreezing, and this is what we were waiting for, really, because this is what we needed for the birds to come back to. And it was quite a frustrating time, because being on an ice shelf, it's an incredibly flat landscape. There are no features whatsoever. You literally see as far as the curvature of the earth falls away from you. And that was one of the reasons Neumayr was chosen, not just because it had a, you know, close and easy colony of penguins, but it would look different to previous Emperor films that have been made before that are surrounded by these enormous icebergs. But still, part of me wanted a load of icebergs, because that is Antarctica, isn't it? It's these massive blocks of ice. And they drift into the bay overnight, and then we'd get this thin layer of ice, and about minus 25 these temperatures were. And then one bit of wind overnight and the whole thing would break up and the icebergs would drift away again. So what we wanted was, you know, really calm conditions for at least a week, really, just to solidify that top layer and lock everything in place. And hopefully that would happen at the same time as a bunch of icebergs were there. But it was a stunning time of year. The sun had started to set. We'd had 24-hour daylight in the summer. We were getting close to not quite 24-hour darkness, but 24 hours without the sun. But you can see how cold it was. These are these images of literally ripples in the water freezing as they ripple. And the feathery-like patterns are where two bits of ice part. And as they separate, the water in between freezes as it gets exposed to the air. So, yeah, it was, you know, it was a cool time of year to be watching it. And this was what we were waiting for. Early April, the first bird started to return. And we'd seen the odd one, but what we were after was the thousands to return that our colony would consist of. We were the colony that we had was about the fourth largest, which in total would end up consisting of about 11,000 individuals. And yeah, this was very strange being stood there, because this is like the day that myself and Will had dreamt about since we were kids. You know, we were all of a sudden stood on the end of this ice shelf, nobody else with us, just the three of us, looking into the distance and these black specks just hovering. And very quickly, hundreds and then thousands, you know, underneath us, making their way to the corner of the bay where they'd breed. And even for a cold place, like in hot places where you get these huge mirages, it was the same, but in the cold temperatures. And the birds, first of all, would appear as specks sort of hovering. And you'd often get an inverted image of them above. So it was a very strange phenomenon as they marched closer. But just to remind you, this is the day that the birds started to arrive. Mm-hmm.
Thousands of emperors are coming to this frozen bay. They are here because the new ice provides the safest place for them to breed. The ice will last 9 months before melting away next summer. And they will need every day of those 9 months to raise the next generation of this great emperor dynasty.
It took about 2 weeks in total for the whole colony to form, and the day I filmed that seal, I remember vividly because this happened about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this is me back in my room about 30 seconds after my little boy Walter was born. I hadn't told my bosses at the BBC about this for risk of them pulling me off the project. 8 months in isolation is a hard enough task as it is mentally. So telling him that I was expecting my first child while I was there, I worried that he said, right, you're not going, we'll send someone else. So I didn't tell him, neither did I tell anybody else on the station. So this was a strange day for everybody down there. My wife likes to point out the little tissue at the bottom of the laptop. On the 20th of May, the sun set for the last time for 62 days where we were in Antarctica. And just like in the summer where I'd never experienced 24-hour daylight, I'd never experienced 24-hour darkness either. The summer hadn't been a problem because you whiz down your blackout blind, it goes dark, you fall asleep, you wake up, you pull it open, it's daylight again. But without the sun, it played havoc with my sleep patterns. And we'd be outside working in horrendous conditions. At this point, temperatures were dropping to, you know, well below minus 40, and they were exhausting every day. And I'd get back, and all I wanted to do was rest and sleep and recover for the next day. And I'd go to bed at 8 o'clock and still be lying awake at 2 a.m., incredibly angry with myself that I'd not managed to fall asleep. But it was a period of time that I was expecting not a lot to be happening. I, if I'm honest, thought it would be dark for 2 months and that we wouldn't be able to get much done. But what was different to this trip compared to the last time the BBC wintered down there, which ironically was for the first Planet Earth, back then they were still filming on film cameras. So the advance in technology and the cameras that we were able to take down there was kit that, you know, could cope with a lot more. We did test some kit back in the year before we left in Southampton. We put 6 cameras into a freezer room, dropped the temperature to minus 40. All of a sudden, 3 cameras stopped working. So then we had another 3 to choose from. And we took 2. But not only the temperatures could they cope with such low temperatures, they could film in a lot lower light. And even over midday, when the sun was closest to the horizon, but not quite breaking it, with such a bright white landscape, the amount of light was, you know, quite amazing. And there was just beauty everywhere. But also, it was important that we could film through this period, because at this time, all the penguins had done was had courted and paired up. We still had mating, egg laying, the transfer of the egg, the males huddling. You know, the bulk of their behavior happened when there was no sun. So yeah, it was key that we had this period to, or this kit to get us through those darker months. Just to give you an idea of my morning routine, it was a process I mastered pretty quickly. It would take me about 20 minutes each morning. Like I say, conditions had dropped to below minus 40. And believe it or not, those clear days that look the prettiest are the worst. They're like a frosty morning here in the UK, whereas the cloudy ones are slightly warmer. And I'd finish this process every morning, dripping with sweat, desperate to get outside. And within 5 minutes outside, I'd be freezing cold and desperate to get back inside. But yeah, all this kit really was key, because without it, we wouldn't have survived outside. I think you can tell this day I wasn't super keen on going out this day. Every day I'd take a flask with me and a sandwich, but within 5 minutes, the sandwich would be rock hard. And I'd never be able to take my hands out my gloves to be able to pour a flask. But one of the most exciting things I was looking forward to was filming behavior, which very few people get to see. And obviously filming the Empress throughout the year, we had to record how they battled storms. And part of me didn't want a storm to hit because I didn't want them to be fighting for their lives with an egg on their feet. Obviously, at this point, these are all males. By this point, the females have left. But on the other hand, part of me did want to witness a storm because I was desperate to see, you know, how they've evolved and how they do manage to withstand the most horrendous conditions on our planet. But filming in a storm took a huge amount of planning. We couldn't go and look for the birds in a storm because that would have been, quite frankly, stupid. Looking for, a tight colony when they're all huddled together like this, they take up a really small amount of space. Even though there's 6,000 birds there, it's a real small part of the ice. And you never quite know where they are without being able to see them because they do move. So looking for the birds in bad weather would have been silly. So we needed to be down there about lunchtime, obviously when we had the most amount of light to film. And we had to be there before the storm hit. Only on two occasions did we get lucky. Very quickly the weather intensified and the wind started hitting. And the birds just bury themselves like this. And the birds on the outer edge walk around the colony to the more sheltered side. And over a period of time, the whole colony can shift. And for me, especially filming the birds walking towards me away from the exposed side and to the sheltered side, that meant me filming into the storm. And you can see I've got goggles on there. They're only around my forehead because obviously I need to look down the camera viewfinder. And it's like being shot with all these tiny little bullets because the air is full of ice. And very quickly you develop frost nip, which is the precursor to frostbite, which start off with these great big white patches. And you don't feel these white patches coming. So if you miss them, you're in trouble because then frostbite kicks in. So every 10 minutes, each of us would be checking each other's faces. And, on numerous occasions, you quickly give these white patches a rub. You're all right. You can get rid of it. But if you miss them, then you're in trouble. I did miss one on the bridge of my nose because this was the only part of exposed skin which I had. But at the end of the day, well worth it for the behavior we were seeing. And this is just a little clip from the last 10 minutes of the film about us filming in a storm.
And then the storms come.
We've got proper weather now and really, really strong winds. The colony's just in front of us. Sometimes it disappears behind the snow.
Hovering around 100 kilometres an hour now since it's picked up. What these penguins are having to put up with out there. It's just mind-blowing. We're finally coming to the end of this storm.
There's all sorts of weird rattling sounds and, to be quite honest, I don't know how this station manages to stay standing.
What we filmed the birds in was literally half of what they have to put up with. It just becomes too unsafe and we have to get back to the station. And we'd been warned about these massive storms before we went down there, that could last a week or two at a time. And we've been given these two great big aluminium boxes to fill with personal items to keep ourselves sane, if you like, through these periods of downtime. It's embarrassing, but the station had great internet. And this is me watching the Tour de France one day. I also took with me a bunch of GCSE German books. I thought this would be a great opportunity to learn a new language. I learned one word across the whole year. So I took a unicycle. I did learn to ride the unicycle. And I took a violin. But don't ask about that one because that didn't come out of its box either. I also offered to cook when we had these long periods off to give the chef a break. So anything really to keep our minds going, because the last thing you want to do is get bored, desperate to get home when you can't get home. There wasn't actually that much spare time because a lot of it, the first few days after each storm, we'd either be building or modifying kit, trying to work out what would make our lives easier, because a really, really good day in Antarctica is a horrendous one anywhere else on this planet. Just the challenges you have to overcome with wearing such massive gloves and not being able to breathe and lenses that are frosting up. So it was a constant learning process. But we did have some humorous times in bad weather. And this was one day where, like a true Brit, I thought I'd go outside and make a cup of tea. So just to give you an idea of how horrendous some of these weather storms were. Yeah, this one didn't go to plan. But on a serious note, if I opened that front door and got blown just a few meters away, straight away, my goggles would fill with snow, my pockets would fill with snow, I wouldn't be able to see. There's a real risk you can't find that door again, even though you're just a few meters away, in which case you are stuck. So, you know, it was sensible not to open that door, and that was the last time I attempted to make a cup of tea. I think filming an Aurora Australis, or the Southern Lights over the colony, has to be the holy grail in wildlife filmmaking. And it certainly was for me. It hadn't really been done properly before. And being in Antarctica and having all this time and being there through a winter and having no sun for 2 months, I thought, no problem, we'll get this. We're in the best place for an Aurora. We've got a colony of 11,000 penguins. Leave it with us. Anyway, it proved, you know, a lot more difficult than I thought. These first images were actually taken before the sea had refrozen, so we didn't have any penguins at this point. I'd only ever seen two auroras, two northern lights, from my back garden in the Lake District prior to these ones, so I didn't really have any idea of how they would appear in the sky and how to go about filming them when I did get an opportunity. So all I could do was point the camera in the direction of the station. What we needed when the birds finally returned, this is, just to give you an idea, this is the males huddling in the middle of winter, and that's the moon, that's not the sun. But we needed three conditions to fall into place for us to succeed. One is a big moon. We didn't really want to just film the lights. We wanted to film the birds underneath them. And the moon would light up the birds enough for three or four nights a month at its brightest for our cameras to be able to pick up the birds. We obviously needed clear skies, otherwise we wouldn't see an aurora. But also we needed a strong aurora above those clouds, you know, as a subject. And we went through the winter with very, you know, we'd get the auroras, but it'd always be cloudy or stormy. And we'd never have a chance with the birds. We got to September and the sun had returned by this point. Very quickly, we were getting longer and longer days. We were getting almost 20 minutes of extra daylight every day. So we were running out of darkness. And if an aurora hits during the day, you're not going to see it. But fortunately, it's bizarre, but they can forecast auroras incredibly effectively. And one day towards the end of September, we were told via this online service that within 48 hours, an enormous aurora will hit, be ready. So we put all our efforts in. We went to sleep during the day. We went down to the colony at night. And that first night, nothing. And we thought, you know what, if this aurora peaks during the day and we can't see it, we've missed our opportunity. Anyway, we went back the following evening and we looked out. With what turned out to be the biggest aurora in 10 years. The peak of activity only lasted maybe 20 minutes, but the aurora was always there in the sky, but this intensity was something else. And the advance in technology allowed us to film the event in real time. So it was so bright and the moon, you know, gave off so much light and our cameras were so sensitive. It was the first time that an aurora could have been filmed over an emperor penguin colony. So, yeah, just to remind you, this is the sequence that we ended up with.
There is occasionally a respite from the brutality of Antarctica. Clear skies, gentle winds, and a particularly spectacular display of the Southern Lights, the Aurora Australis. Thank you.
I've seen that so many times now, but it's still quite emotional watching it, knowing that I've seen arguably the most beautiful sight that our planet can offer. And I don't know how few people have been in amongst an emperor colony with the Southern Lights above them, but you know, I feel extremely lucky to have experienced that. We came into spring and I had these mad visions in my head of filming chicks running around in this new beautiful blue and white frozen landscape with a massive improvement in weather, but that couldn't have been further from it. The wind just became so unpredictable, and for weeks we'd have these not horrendous storms, but constant wind. And for me at 6 foot, not that bad, but for a chick that's only 30 centimeters high with wind blowing drifts of snow across the surface, it's a different world down there. They can't see where they're going, and it's very easy to get lost from your parents. Yeah, it was a very challenging time. Temperatures rose to about minus 25 quite quickly. And believe it or not, minus 25, we were referring to as warm. Those were conditions where without any wind, you could actually take your gloves off and your hat off for, you know, half an hour or so and just give your mouth a break and be able to breathe. Because with a balaclava on, you constantly feel like you're being suffocated. And after a couple of months like that, you know, you just want to rip it off. But the problem was you rip this quite moist balaclava off from you breathing in and out of it, and within 2 minutes it's frozen solid around your neck and you can't pull it back up again. So yeah, it was a tricky time. Throughout the season, the weather conditions blow snow up. So on the left you can see the shelf ice, and the top of there is where I'd been filming the killer whales from in the summer. I've taken this image from stood on the sea ice, and over the period of the winter, drifts of snow get blown up against this wall of ice and eventually form this ramp that joins the two. And that makes it then easier for penguins to walk up and down, for us to drive up and down. But before the two meet, they form these enormous gullies, you know, that could be 60 to 70 foot deep. And towards the end of September, we experienced probably the biggest storm we had done all year. And it lasted just over 2 weeks. And we knew the longer the storm lasted, the further the colony would shift. And it started in its usual place on the sea ice. But with that rotating mechanism that I told you about, the longer the storm lasts, the further they're going to move. And we worried for them at this point because there was no way we could even open the front door, let alone get down and see how they were getting on. But we knew this obstacle stood in their way. So when we returned to the colony and found utter carnage, if I'm quite honest, it was quite a difficult day. We'd been with the birds about 10 months at this point, and they did feel like family. You know, we'd been with them almost every day that we could. We'd only taken 2 or 3 days off where the weather was good enough to go down and film. We'd relied on bad weather to give us our days off. And yeah, seeing all these birds stuck in these gullies, almost given up, was very difficult. A lot of them would hang their heads low, and quite a few chicks, unfortunately, had already died at this point. But with chicks having recently hatched, a lot of them were still relying on their parents for warmth. So they were still on the feet of either their father or their mother. And they simply didn't have the strength to keep themselves warm out of that. So birds in there with chicks on their feet couldn't use the full mobility of their feet to get themselves out. Birds that unfortunately lost their chicks and that could use their feet fully, believe it or not, could scale these walls no problem. They'd use their beak as an ice axe, and their extremely strong claws, and they'd pull themselves out. And very quickly we saw that the birds that were stuck down there with chicks were having to make this horrendous decision, either to ditch their chick and leave it, you know, in the bottom of this gully unable to get out and save themselves, or both stay there and, you know, reach that inevitable fate. So we filmed what we could. We were forced back to the station for a day. And when we did get down there again, we decided, you know what, we can't walk away from this knowing we haven't done anything. It was a unique situation because these birds hadn't been driven in there by predator. We weren't disrupting the balance of nature here. The emperors were the only creatures in Antarctica at this point. There weren't any predators. They don't arrive until later on in the year, by which point any dead penguin would have been buried and unable to reach. Plus, dying penguins at this point just freeze instantly, so no way predators can feed on them. So we thought, you know what, we'll give them an option. And that's what we did. We dug into the steep walls of ice just to create a shallow enough ramp for them to shuffle up without having to let go of their chicks. And I remember digging this ramp and looking over at the group of birds thinking, I know you're intelligent, but do you know what we're actually trying to do here? And believe it or not, within literally 30 seconds, a minute from walking away from the top of this ramp, the first bird shuffled its way over and started walking out. And that's all it took. The rest followed. And it was a magical feeling. And the production team ummed and ahed whether to include this because, you know, it was seen as controversial. But I think likely it would have been seen as controversial if we hadn't have done anything. So those of you who haven't seen it, this was that day.
Hopefully the weather will clear again tomorrow and we can get back down here and, fingers crossed, there'll be a few less birds in this hole.
2 days later, the weather allows the team to return to the colony. Already the gully has claimed more casualties. The team decide to act.
We've given it a lot of thought. We've decided that we are definitely going to dig a shallow ramp that they will hopefully use.
It's very rare for the film crew to intervene, but they realise that they may be able to save at least some of these birds simply by digging a few steps in the ice.
Oh man, Will, look.
Oh my goodness. We were literally just about to leave, but the first birds are definitely making their way out, which is brilliant. So hopefully they'll just make their way back to the colony and them and their chicks will have a much better chance of survival, because there's no chance that they were going to survive down there at all.
That was actually the last big event that the penguins had to put up with. That gully was the last big storm which they experienced, and from then on it was a case of just filming them getting bigger. We were quite, for an emperor colony, we were quite deep in Antarctica for emperors to breed. What I'm getting at is that because it's still so cold in the spring, it takes a bit longer for predators to arrive and for summer visitors to get to this part. They are predated on by orcas, leopard seals, giant petrels, a big species of gull will attempt to take smaller penguins. But by this point, thankfully, they'd grown big enough to be past that stage. But yeah, it was a lovely time to be around the colony. And very quickly, they learned that just like their parents, they relied on one another for survival. And any smaller storms we got, they'd very quickly huddle together and they'd form their little creches. And at the point where they're sort of left to their own devices, both parents go off and feed. So they're left for maybe a week at a time on their own. And amazingly, in a colony of 11,000, they recognize their parents' call when they come back to feed. But with only having to film the chicks getting bigger, we were given time to explore. So we nipped over to our nearest group of icebergs, which were probably about 15 kilometers into the middle of the bay. We'd managed to get over a little bit in the winter, but conditions were a lot tougher then. And at this point, we were almost at 24 hours of daylight. But because our trip was coming to an end, we were desperate to make the most out of this place. And we'd go over to these icebergs, we'd film until the sun set at 10:30, 11 at night, we'd go back to the station, grab a cup of tea, and then if the weather forecast was good, we'd literally grab half an hour and then go again and be back out at the icebergs as the sun rose. And even in -25, -30, I was so tired I'd be falling asleep driving my skidoo, but we were getting the most out of the place, and it really did make the difference because a lot of that stuff was used in the final film. What I had forgotten, driving around on this landscape for almost an entire year, I'd forgotten that I was stood on, a metre or two of ice and then hundreds of metres of water underneath me. And as the season progressed, you can see from this that the whole bay started to flex underneath our feet. And we were all right. I think we would have got warning if the whole place would have broken up. But it was, a reminder of, you know, where we'd been. Also, it felt a privilege to have been the only people in this landscape, because the sea had frozen in the autumn. These icebergs had frozen in place in the position they had frozen. But come the spring, it would all melt and disappear. And that landscape in that way, at that moment, wouldn't exist again. And we were the only people to have experienced it like that. For the chicks, the parents just decide one day not to return. And it's hunger that drives them to fledge themselves. So they make their way further north, eventually getting to the ice edge. And you actually see a group of penguins just behind the ones I've taken a picture of. And they're literally just about to fledge for the first time. And that's them. They won't return for another 4 years, I think, and that's when they're old enough to come back and breed. And although this was you know, a lovely time to be in amongst them and still new stuff that I hadn't experienced, it was a tricky time for me because I'd lived down there for almost a year. I'd got very used to the way of life living in Antarctica. Time doesn't exist. Money doesn't exist. Boundaries don't exist. You know, everybody helps out each other when they can. And I very quickly knew that my time was coming to an end. And yeah, we started getting ready. It was a case of, you know, a plane's on its way. You've got 24 hours to pack your bags kind of thing. They react to weather that quickly. And it was something I found very difficult coming to terms with, especially having been lucky enough to spend a year with arguably the most charismatic animals on the planet. So just to remind you, my wife made me put this in.
The crew followed the chicks as they grew up. And after months with the emperors, their time in Antarctica is finally coming to a close.
We're coming to the end of the trip now. And yeah, we've had an amazing year. And I'm obviously desperate to get home. But there's an old part of me that doesn't want to leave. What a privilege, eh?
It's you know, it's an incredibly magical place, Antarctica, and especially being there during the winter, and that's what requires the commitment. During the summer, with all that sunlight, it's just a white and blue landscape, and that's, you know, it's blinding. But to really experience the magic, you've got to wait until that sun starts to set and you get the colours in the sky and then you get the darkness. Obviously, with no light pollution, you know, it's completely pure. And I'd spent a year breathing the purest air on the planet. So when I did eventually get back, it was a real shock. But I think 10, 15 years ago, I'd have really struggled with a trip like this. Just the simplicity of being able to check the news or being able to call home whenever I wanted. We were actually on the same time zone as the UK. So for my wife back home, I could literally pick up the phone whenever I wanted and you know, talk and send messages. But I do feel, you know, I don't know how many people can say they've spent a year living with emperor penguins, but, you know, I feel so lucky to have been given this opportunity. And I'm going to leave you with one video which I sent back to my wife. We were sending pictures and videos all the time. You either love the cold or you hate it. Fortunately, I love it.
Hi, darling. It's a little bit chilly today. You'd hate it. Oh, dear.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, you say it's a privilege that you had to go there, but you've given us something very special through the footage that you took, the speech that you've given tonight, but also your book. It's just tremendous. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions? I'm sure we've got loads of questions. Who's going to go first? Yes, thank you.
Yeah, every year they simply haven't got time to look for their previous partner. Yeah, they have got to use the maximum amount of time that the sea ice is there before it melts away. So yeah, they find a new one every year. We had, yeah. Well, we obviously had strict rules to stick to. We had to keep 30 meters from the huddle. But that's very difficult when you set up the camera kit and you turn around to operate it and you've got three individuals asleep next to it all. A lot of them had probably never seen a human before, so had no reason to be afraid of us. And yeah, we're just super inquisitive all the time. And every day we'd have a few birds, whether they were the same or different birds, I don't know. But I like to think they enjoyed our company as much as we enjoyed theirs. No. Oh, the chicks, yeah. No, you just sit still and they'll just all come running over to you. And you know, within 30 seconds, they're off again chasing each other around. So, not of humans, no. Yeah, no reason to be afraid. So, but yeah, it was a unique situation because obviously a lot of wildlife just vanishes as soon as it sees you. So,
but you don't recognise one penguin from another?
No, they're all. I mean, we've got a colony of 11,000. We did have one, and I have written about it. We had one all black penguin, which apparently was new to science. It was just when I first spotted it, I thought it was the back of a penguin, you know, because they've got black backs. But then I realised, like an owl, it had its head 180 degrees pointing at me. And then I looked at its feet and it had white toenails and it was completely jet black, which was bizarre. And we did see that individual three times, once before the winter. I imagine it went back to sea for the winter and then returned. But it's funny, it walked through the colony and the other penguins didn't like it. They just all parted. And so it probably never bred. But yeah, it was very unusual. We did ask scientists when we got back and they had no idea that this existed.
Did you get any other unusual footage from anything else that you captured that hadn't been seen before? I mean, there was the kidnapping, wasn't there?
We got the kidnapping, which was not unheard of, but to film it in such detail was pretty unique. The snowball, where a pair was incubating a snowball rather than an egg, which they reckon was just practicing. The relocation hadn't been... So after a couple of storms in the winter, the males got pushed so close to the area where the gully was, that they all marched back to the place where they'd started. And the scientists we were in touch with didn't quite know why they were doing that. But when some got stuck in the gully, I think it became obvious that they were trying to avoid that. So by walking back, they were making their way further from this gully so the next storm wouldn't take them into it, if you like. But eventually that 2-week storm was just too much.
No, somebody else. We'll come back to you.
Yeah. Well, no, a lot of this was the life cycle of the birds. But the series, you know, as with the chimps and the wild dogs, was hugely reliant on what happened when we were there. For us, we obviously couldn't follow one individual family because we've got a colony of 10,000 that are all identical. So our story was the whole colony as a family. And those little bits, like the relocation, we only saw happen twice. The snowball being incubated, we only saw happen once. The kidnapping, we only saw happen once. You know, key part that the aurora only happened once. Those huge parts of the final film, we only saw once. But luckily, they happened in front of me in such detail that we could capture enough at that one time to tell that part of the story. And the gully as well, that only happened once. So, yeah, without those tiny events that happened down there, it would just have been another emperor story that everybody... Yeah, no, a huge amount of luck, yeah.
Anybody else? Yes, thank you.
The smell wasn't that bad, if I'm honest. When they poo, it just freezes immediately. But when the males are huddling on really cold days, it can be, what, minus 60 outside. But in the middle of the huddle, it can be plus 37 degrees, same as us. You know, it's incredibly effective. But they can still get too warm. So birds in the middle, if they get too warm, to get out, every other bird's got a part. So all of a sudden, you'd have this stampede of penguins with eggs on their feet trying to get into open ground to make sure they're safe. But with the colony parting, the huddle parting like that, you get these enormous clouds of steam go up into the air. And if you were downwind of one of those, you were in trouble. Yeah. But most of the time, they're all right. Yeah.
Another one?
Oh, no, 100%. If it wasn't for family, I'd do another 11 months, no problem. But I've done my time, you know, I've done my time. I've lived my dream now. Plus, I wouldn't want to miss. I've got two boys now, so I wouldn't want to miss that chunk of time again. But I like to think a trip over a summer will come about and I can get back down there because I've seen emperors are probably the species I've seen the most of. You know, I've only spent a year of them, but having seen them every day, it's quite strange knowing that there's a real chance I'll never see another one again. So, yeah, I like to think I'll get a short trip in 1 year.
But what was it like when you did come back home after 11 months? I mean, getting used to society and money and everything.
Yeah, no, it was strange. I was panicking. I'd not seen a tree. I'd not seen a car. I'd not seen a blue tit, you know, all these normal things. I'd not seen anybody else other than my 12 colleagues. But fortunately, being thrown into parenthood with a 7-month-old, I didn't really have time to think, which I think was a massive help. But one thing I hadn't considered was, having not been exposed to any bacteria or illness down there, my immune system had slowly been shutting down. So I got back and all of a sudden was exposed to all these germs. For literally 5 months, I was knocked for six and couldn't do anything. I was started with a week of sickness and then every cold under the sun, just as my immune system built itself back up again. And that really, yeah, that took some getting used to. I did think I was never going to get better, but you know, it was worth it. So, no, I did get offered in the winter vitamin D tablets because you've got no sun. So they'll take these, you'll be fine. And typical stubborn self, no, don't give me that, I'll be all right. I probably would have slept if I'd taken those tablets. But yeah, no, they didn't warn me about coming back. But yeah, I'll never have to experience it again. So.
Yes.
Well, I started on Spring Watch and Autumn Watch, and then various Natural Worlds. In fact, the last the program that aired on Sunday, so this current series, Seven Worlds, we did a fair bit for that Antarctic episode as well while we were down there making this, actually. It's obviously such an expensive venture sending a crew down to Antarctica for 11 months that we sort of doubled up there and we did what we could for them while we were there. Yeah, there's a lot going on now. There's obviously Netflix, there's Apple TV, there's Amazon Prime. You know, there's so much happening and everybody's wanting wildlife programs now. So, yeah, it's only getting more popular. Not at the moment, but yeah, things are changing. So we'll see what happens.
Sorry, your question.
No, I don't think so. I definitely learned I was a lot tougher than I thought I was. The couple of months before leaving, I was literally waking up in cold sweats thinking, what have I agreed to here? You know, being away, not the penguins, but being away from home for that length of time, leaving my wife on her own. Yeah, you know, I just thought, crikey, maybe I can't deal with this. And I very nearly came to throwing the towel in, but fortunately I didn't tell anyone. I sat it out and it was all right. But yeah, it's a funny feeling being abandoned at the bottom of the planet for that length of time.
Yeah. What proof have you gathered that you
think you well, to be honest, where we were, temperatures are actually getting colder. So they're not 100% what's going on down there. I mentioned about that British station, Halley. So 60 kilometers from there, in Halley Bay, they had a colony of 20,000 plus emperors, I think. And only in recent years that colony collapsed, purely because the sea ice is not lasting long enough for the birds to breed. So they're returning in the autumn, they're laying their eggs, but then before the chicks get to an age where they can swim, the ice is breaking up. And I think 2 or 3 years, they didn't, you know, 20,000 birds didn't raise one chick. So they've since realized this place isn't safe anymore and they've dispersed. And a few have gone to another colony. They're still trying to work out where the rest of the birds have gone to. But, you know, a collapse in that size colony, and it barely hit the news in the UK, you know, is surely a sign of what's to come. So we'll see.
One more. Yes.
I always wanted to film grizzlies, wolves and emperors. Emperors was top of the list. I've been very lucky to have done all three. I'd love to go back. I really can't imagine not seeing an emperor again in my life. Yeah, so no, the dream would be to go back. Yeah, I did a jungle trip last year and it was horrendous. Like, temperatures were 40 degrees, 98% humidity, bugs everywhere. Living in a wooden shed, it hammered it down 3 p.m. every day. So uncomfortable. Yeah, I much preferred this kind of stuff.
Sorry, you did have one question. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, the British were maybe slightly clever and they put theirs on skis so they could tow it. Neumeyer, they just decided to just bring it down. I don't know what will happen to it. It may even get built back in Germany again just to, as a tourist attraction or something. Or they'll take, yeah, completely. The whole thing will be, yeah, gone are the days where they used to build stations either on the ice or under the ice. They'd dig holes and build the stations. But with that kind of weather, very quickly the stations get buried. The pressure of the ice shelf just crushes the station and they have to be abandoned. And Neumeyer 2 is still there in the ice shelf, slowly moving close to the edge. But yeah, gone are the days now where they'll leave that kind of stuff there. So the thing with Neumeyer is you could see it was on stilts. That was the thing to try and combat the snow burying it. So now the wind blows snow underneath it rather than against it. But still, being on such a flat landscape, it changes the wind currents. And it's now on a mound of, it was on flat ice to start with, but every year they have to lift it slowly just to keep up with the buildup of snow. So every year I think it's lifted about a meter or two. It's quite a lot. So yeah.
Well, you caught some amazing footage. You've spoken to us very eloquently this evening, and you write beautifully, in my opinion. The book is so readable and real page turner. How did the book come about?
I've always wanted to write a book, but never had enough to write about, not enough for my liking. I did start writing when I was in Antarctica. I did the first 3 months, you know, I'd sit down and, but I just couldn't keep up. You know, it was just taking so much time. And then I got back, and yeah, I was approached. And I think without that, I'd never have got around to it. I had a deadline of the beginning of June this year, but Ernest, my youngest, was due to be born in April. And I thought, right, if I don't get this done by April, it'll never happen. So yeah, I hammered it from sort of Christmas till April and thankfully got it done. But
well, yes, I'm sure we're all going to be very grateful that you did get it done. It's a brilliant book. It's a fantastic read. It's got some brilliant pictures in it as well. And I think it's a fantastic Christmas present. So you may have a copy for yourself, but do think about all those people that you'd like to buy it for Christmas. Suitable for every member of the family. And tonight, because you're here, it's at the special price of £15 for your extra copy. So do think about it, and you can get it signed and have further chat with Lindsay before you go. But that's it for the evening tonight. So if you could join me in giving Lindsay a big round of applause. Thank you very much.
Thank you.